Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You're listening to Season 3, Episode 3 of Kicking the Chiroarchy with me, Elena. This is the original intersectional feminist podcast that aims to subvert and challenge the norm by providing a platform to voices, stories, and narratives ignored by the mainstream. Okay, all right, I think we're getting into the swing of things now a little bit, you and me. We've released 3 episodes and the world hasn't totally imploded, physically speaking at least, of course. It could definitely do with some work in some areas. And that's why we're here, to challenge the mother flipping chiroarchy in the best way we know how, and that's by sharing and telling stories. Right now we're exploring reproductive health. So far in this series of episodes, we've spoken to Diane in episode 1, an activist who was part of the effort that helped legalise abortion in the UK in 1967, and then Gabriella in episode 2, who spoke very matter-of-factly about the abortion she had in the UK recently. This episode, we will be exploring the health system and the impact austerity in the government has had on our sexual health services. Sexual health clinics are closing all over the country because of budget cuts, and if you're in big cities like London, you might not necessarily feel the pinch. What about people who live further afield, in less well-connected areas, and then add on the additional needs associated with being LGBTQ+, and it becomes even more difficult? This is just one example of how looking after your sexual health has become a class issue. So, to help me explore this, I've invited Dr. Verity Sullivan on, and as always, I'm going to let her introduce herself.
My name's Verity. I'm a 36-year-old cisgendered white woman, and I'm a specialist doctor in sexual health, contraception and HIV, and I currently work in South East London.
Thank you so much for coming on and chatting to us about this topic for this episode, which we're kind of exploring reproductive health and all the various facets and identities and things really that make this topic up in Britain today, I guess, really. My first question to you, given everything that's kind of going on in the world in terms of, I guess, going on in the government, but can you just kind of like set the scene for us?
First off, I think it's great that you guys are opening a dialogue about this, because within the field, obviously as professionals, we're all quite aware of the effects of budget cuts and things on sexual health services. And you know, we all talk about it a lot, but I think in terms of the public, you know, obviously it's something the government don't bang on about, they don't advertise. And I just don't think there's a lot of awareness. So I think it's great that you're talking about it today. So thanks ever so much. So I can just sort of very briefly give you the kind of political, kind of budgety side of things.
Yeah.
I'll try and make it brief because, I don't know, I hear the word austerity and my mind kind of glazes over.
Yeah.
I start thinking about what I want for dinner tonight or something instead. But we know what austerity is. So essentially the country's in an economic crisis. The government decides to implement policies where it reduces the amount they spend on public services. And within that, you know, you've got things like education and healthcare, which we're talking about today.
Yeah.
So you will have seen, I'm sure, you know, all the news coverage about, you know, NHS crisis, and, you know, basically healthcare can't keep up with demand, essentially, with our growing population, evolving technologies, things like that. But sexual health and contraception has been hit very hard. And there's a bit of kind of a longer story around that. So around sort of 2012 and 13, the government implemented a policy called the Health and Social Care Act. And there were lots of things that this changed. But one of the things that it changed is it removed the way that sexual health services are paid for. And what it did is it meant that local authorities or local councils were then responsible for funding their local sexual health services. So say, you know, you live in Lambeth. Lambeth Council are then responsible for deciding how much money gets spent on your local sexual health and contraceptive service. The problem with that is that the money that local councils get to fund those services comes from the public health budget. And because of austerity, the public health budget has been slashed beyond belief. So just to put it into context, so in December just gone, in 2018, the government announced they were slashing the public health budget by £85 million. And between 2014 and 2020, it's estimated the entire cuts will be around £700 million. Wow. So, I mean, you know, even those figures, just saying them out loud, you can see that, you know, what are these councils supposed to be doing? Okay.
So what is that in, like, in terms of percentage? How much are we talking there?
I don't know in terms of percentage exactly, but what I can tell you is that year on year we're spending less, despite the fact that demand for sexual health services is increasing. So a recent survey showed that in 2017 versus 2013, the number of attendances at sexual health clinics has gone up by 13%, but despite that, the budget has fallen dramatically.
Why is it then that our public health services are taking such a battering?
Well, I mean, I think that's sort of a question for kind of government, really, hey?
Yeah, true.
You know, and it's not just healthcare services that are suffering, obviously, you know, yeah. There's, you know, education suffering, you know, law enforcement, all sorts of public services are all really feeling the pinch, and you know as a nation we're not very, very happy about it at all. In terms of sexual health, you know, the fact that we rely so keenly on this public health budget and we rely so much on our local councils making decisions, you know, that's an awful lot of responsibility. And you know, these massively stark cuts, you know, as I said, it's not something the government's really talking about. You know, lots of other things are going on at the moment, you know, Brexit type thing. And it's kind of really removing focus from the fact that these other things are actually going on a little bit under the radar.
You talked about the £700 million. Is that by 2020?
Yeah, so that's predicted by 2020, yeah.
What is the impact that that's going to have on our local services?
Well, I think another thing to say is, alongside these budget cuts, other things have changed as well. Okay, so When local authorities commission or provide a sexual health service, what they quite often do is they put an idea out about what they might like from a service. And what lots of different providers or companies can then do is they can bid for that service. So, for example, I might be someone in local council. I might say, I work in this area. I need a sexual health service that can provide STI testing, contraception. And in particular, we've got a really, you know, big young people's population where we live. So we need a dedicated young person service as well. And I would put that kind of contract out and I would say to all these different healthcare providers, who can give me the best price, essentially? Who can give me the most for my money? And the problem with that is that you can then get, obviously, NHS services, well-established services, you know, bidding for those contracts. But what you can also get are then private providers, okay? So you might have heard of privatisation of healthcare services, who might say, well, we can do it as well and we can do it for less. And the problem with that is that quite often private providers can give you more for your money, but quite often your quality suffers a little bit with that as well. You're losing all the expertise of very well-established services that have been around for a long time. The other issue with that is that you can then get services that are being provided by lots and lots of different people, which isn't really very good for kind of continuous service, okay? Mm-hmm. And what you then lose are some of these really well-established partnerships that you've got between clinics, okay? And the other thing that you lose is the fact that, you know, different services are being paid for by lots of different people. So just to give you an example, local authorities commission STI testing, contraception and HIV prevention services, okay? However, if you then go to a clinic and you're diagnosed HIV positive, you'll move into a HIV specialist centre, which is actually paid for by somebody else. It makes it very, very difficult for different sectors of sexual health and HIV to all work together. And that's a term we use called fragmented commissioning. Okay, it makes it very hard for patients and doctors to kind of manoeuvre their way through different services,
right.
Which can essentially just make our work more complex. And it can also make it more difficult for patients. I think in terms of how this is actually going to affect people, basically it's going to affect anybody that needs to come to a sexual health service. Now, by no means, you know, not every single person in the UK is having sex, but a pretty large proportion of them have had sex, are having sex, or will have sex in the future. Okay. And, you know, unfortunately, I think even though it's 2019, we do still live in a society where there's quite a lot of stigma around seeking sexual health care. So, you know, for example, if you have a cold or you break your arm, you wouldn't hesitate, you know, emailing your boss and saying, oh, I need to be off for a few days. But if you've got horrible genital herpes or like a raging case of syphilis, you're not really going to phone your boss and say, I need a week off, which is really awful because those things can make you feel really unwell. And, you know, for a sort of general kind of population issue, you know, there's already so many barriers to people trying to get into sexual health. If the government's then going to provide even more barriers by saying we're cutting the amount of money we can give you, we're cutting the amount of services that we can provide, you know, how are people supposed to be encouraged to seek good sexual health and take responsibility for their sexual health? What will happen is because of the reducing budgets, essentially services can't stay open as much as they would like. So what's actually happening around the country is a lot of sexual health and contraceptive services are closing, so they're just shutting their doors. A lot of services that are able to stay open are having to reduce their hours, which has happened to my own service, unfortunately. People are sometimes having to cut staff numbers. And, you know, in particular with contraception, which we might get a chance to talk about a little bit more later, you know, they're restricting services. So they might say you can only come in if you're under 25. I mean, you know, it's just basically, it's discriminating against certain groups. And what will happen within that is, you know, you've got this kind of overall effect of people, you know, not being able to access services as they would wish. But there'll be very particular vulnerable groups within that that will suffer the most. Women, the LGBT community, and particularly, you know, smaller, more BME, and the BME population in particular.
And so, do you have any insight into why it will be women, LGBT people, BME people that will be suffering?
Yeah, sure. So, so essentially what will happen is, you know, you have to remember that some groups will experience poorer sexual health than others, okay? And I think what's important to maybe describe is I think that some people think that a sexual health clinic is you walk in, pee in a pot, get a packet of tablets and that's you all sorted, which couldn't be further from the truth, okay? So just to put it in context for you, so in my sexual health clinic, for example, I very rarely see somebody that just comes in and wants an MOT, okay? Someone that doesn't have any symptoms, they just want to get a sexual health check. They will generally be given a home testing kit that they can take home, okay? Or they'll be assisted to do their own samples in clinic. They won't take a lot of time, okay? Healthcare professionals, so doctors and nurses working in sexual health, our time is generally saved for more complex patients, so using our expertise accordingly, okay? And in sort of an average day for me, I might see somebody with a very nasty STI, you know, quite bad genital herpes, for example, a nasty case of syphilis, perhaps, you know, drug-resistant gonorrhea, which is an increasing problem now. I might see somebody who's a new diagnosis of HIV that needs some extra counselling and work. I might see a victim of rape. I might see someone that's undergone FGM and is experiencing problems for that. And we see a lot of safeguarding cases as well. So, you know, young people that are experiencing sexual abuse, grooming, that sort of thing. And these are patients that are never going to walk up to the reception in a sexual health clinic and say, hello, I've been raped. Can I be seen quickly, please? Quite often these patients will have taken an incredible amount of balls to come in the first place, will want to see a doctor or a nurse. And then, you know, I'd have to talk to you and work out if I trust you or not. I'd have to talk to you and work out what the risks and benefits are of me perhaps telling you my story. Are you going to help me? Am I going to get into trouble for telling you? You know, and by reducing access to sexual health clinics, these patients are losing a voice, okay? In an average day, you know, we have to turn away a certain percentage of patients because we just don't have space to see them, okay? And if that one person who's been getting abused by their partner for the past 6 months decides that's the one day they're going to try and come and we tell them they can't be seen, what happens to them? So, you know, when we're losing this opportunity to really help people that are asking for help, because, you know, people don't just come in and tell you straight away what they want. And I think another sort of similar thing might be, you know, for example, you know, a young gay man that comes in, you know, he's maybe had his first sexual encounter. You know, he doesn't know what he needs to do. You know, that requires, you know, a long consultation where you're talking to somebody about safe sexual health, getting things like vaccination against hepatitis B, which we offer all men who have sex with men, talk about PEP, PrEP, chems, that sort of thing. And, you know, often what we can then do is we can refer people on to relevant support services, holistic support services, things like that. And these are all people that are going to miss out. And talking about the BME community in particular as well, you know, a good example of this is, you know, if you look at HIV rates, for example. So HIV, it's not all bad news. HIV rates are going down, okay, in the UK, which is absolutely amazing. And that's thanks to the fact that, you know, people are on treatment now. If you're on treatment, your virus is suppressed. You can't pass it on to anybody else. People are taking PrEP, which is pre-exposure prophylaxis, a tablet you can take that prevents you acquiring HIV in the first place. So rates of, you know, HIV have gone down by like a third, up to about 45% in London even, yeah? But rates of what we call late diagnosis are quite high still, okay? So late diagnosis just literally means you're diagnosed HIV positive when you're already quite sick from HIV. And the group that affects most are black straight men, okay? Black heterosexual African men. So, right. Yeah, so we need to work harder at getting to these groups of people to encourage HIV testing and to reduce stigma within communities about getting a HIV test. So if you're reducing the amount of appointments you can offer people, if you're reducing the amount of, you know, outreach and holistic care you can offer to people, how are we supposed to fix that?
I'm actually kind of like blown away by how deep this runs. And, you know, this isn't just talking about your average like 16-year-old going to a sexual health clinic and just wanting free condoms. This is talking about rape survivors, survivors of abuse. This is talking about like victims of FGM, you know. This is talking about, like you said, like the heterosexual black men who are being diagnosed late with HIV. Like, these are very deep issues. How does it affect you then when you have to turn people away at your practice and when you know that you can't help people?
Well, it's awful. I mean, it completely goes against, you know, your principles as a doctor. Do you know what I mean? You've been trained to be able to offer people help when they ask for it. And particularly in sexual health, you know, they're very sensitive issues that you deal with. And you're absolutely right, you know, a 16-year-old even coming for condoms. I mean, that takes balls to do that when you're 16.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean?
So true.
Exactly. And, you know, I think the thing to sort of point out is that we do have a lot of safeguards in place in clinics as well. So, for example, in my clinic in South London, we have a do not turn away policy. So there are certain, you know, if a patient comes in who's 17 or under, we will see them. You know, we will stay late. We will see them. If a person comes in and does explicitly tell us they've been raped, they need post-exposure prophylaxis, they are on our do not turn away list and we will see them. But I think the point I'm trying to make is quite often people won't tell you that.
Right.
Okay. They come into their appointments, they tell you they've got a bit of discharge, they tell you they need the pill as a sort of an in almost, okay, just to try and get into the consultation room and work out if they're able to confide in you at all. I think a big thing to mention is probably contraception as well, because that's something that's really, really suffering at the moment. So the Family Planning Association, or the FPA, did a report called Unprotected Nation back in 2015. And they basically looked at the kind of, you know, long-term financial implications of contraceptive services being cut. And they estimated that for every £1 cut in spending would result in an 86% increase in a long-term spend for the government, just in terms of increasing in STIs and unplanned pregnancies. I think, like I said already, you know, if you're reducing your clinic hours, then you're reducing access to emergency contraception. You're reducing access to people getting hold of different methods of contraception and having the opportunity to talk about the different methods that are available to them. And the other thing is, yeah, you've got this age restriction. So in some places, you know, if you're over 25, then your access is restricted, because obviously if you're over 25, it doesn't matter if you get pregnant, right?
Right, obviously.
So yeah, it's really bad because, you know, as a nation, we're actually very lucky. You know, I mean, there's these much bigger issues of, you know, the fact that contraception has to come down to women. There should be more choice. There needs to be more research for male-led methods of contraception. There needs to be more research into, you know, side effects from contraception. That's a different issue, right? I think. But I think what we do have to focus on is the fact that we do have access to a wide range of contraceptive methods. It is free, provided you can get hold of it. And personally, I think it's quite a, you know, at a time when I think globally reproductive rights are being questioned, particularly, you know, you look in the US at the moment, I think the government has to be quite careful, okay? Because, you know, the government's always very kind of pro, you know, equality, women's rights. But actually, if you're limiting women's access to reproductive health care, then that's quite a big statement, you know. And it's really, really important to keep women's access open, because that way, you know, you're allowing people to make choices. You're allowing women just to have sex for the sake of having sex rather than procreation, okay? And I just think personally that's something that we have to be quite careful about.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
I mean, this is a massive priority. You know, you talk about women being able to have sex without getting pregnant, you know, not just for procreation. And that is, like, you know, women should be able to have that power over and the autonomy over their bodies and what they do with this. And this is absolutely a women's rights issue, and it shouldn't be something that's just like swept under the carpet. We're in London. We're sat in Leicester Square. We're right around the corner from Soho. You know, I've been to 56 Dean Street on my lunch break and gone and got a full STI workup within an hour.
Great stuff.
Yeah. You know, so I'm really lucky in that sense that there's something on my doorstep. I live in London. There's clinics dotted all over London. If I really wanted to get the help, it's pretty accessible for me. But, you know, what about your average person who lives like in the sticks in the country somewhere, you know? Or what about a young LGBT teenager who lives in the middle of nowhere and has to, you know, rely on their parents to drive them to town?
Yeah, I mean, devastated, right? If you
yeah
absolutely.
What is this, you know, is this a class issue?
Well, I think I think you've made a really, really good point, because what is sometimes a bit more interesting to look at is actually which groups are being disproportionately affected.
Right.
Okay. And if you look at STI rates, okay, and rates of poor sexual health, the highest in young people, age 16 to 25. So exactly as you've mentioned, the people that are relying on mum and dad to get them places, people that don't have a lot of money for public transport. Exactly as you said, if you don't live in London or another big city, you might have to travel like tens of miles to get to a sexual health clinic. So these people are being discriminated against, particularly if you know their local clinic has just been shut down because of austerity. The other group is men who have sex with men are disproportionately affected by STIs. And we know that the LGBT community is disproportionately affected by poor sexual health and mental health issues linked to sexual health. Mm. And then the third group is, black minority and ethnic communities as well. You're absolutely right. There are absolutely certain groups that are being really discriminated against within this. And I think another thing that's important to mention is, you know, despite all this kind of gloom and doom I'm kind of telling you about, you know, sexual health, you know, the specialty is really proud of the work that it does. And we're still always making really big strides to try and improve things as well. A really big thing that's come in recently is, I don't know if you've seen online testing that you can do.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. So particularly in London, the majority of clinics now, you can actually get a home testing kit. You can do it yourself at home and then send it back to the laboratory and you get your clinic results very quickly. Or you can order it online as well. That's great if A, you're literate, you know how to use the internet, you've got a good sense of assessing your own risk, and you're going to be able to understand the instructions that are sent to you. So it's a really great initiative for moving work away from overstretched clinics, but it obviously only serves a certain population, which are going to be people that know how to, people that are just perhaps, you know, better with their language, and maybe people that are just a little bit more comfortable, you know, with accessing that sort of service. The people that aren't going to be able to maybe do that, and the people that maybe do need to see a doctor are, your kind of young LGBT community that need to come in and talk to a doctor or a nurse about what's going on with them, somebody that's been experiencing a problem like we've discussed already. So I think one group of patients that are going to be affected are young people. So in particularly 17s and unders. So for all intents and purposes, when you're still 17 and under, you're still classed as a child. Okay. Right. Now, I think, as I said already, if you are 17 and under and you come to the majority of clinics, you will get seen, okay? Most clinics have a sort of do not turn away policy, so they will really endeavour to kind of see young people where they can. I think the problem is, though, is even if you're being told you're going to be seen, that doesn't mean you're not going to have to wait, okay? And we did some work in our own clinic, sort of talking to young people, sort of saying, how can we improve your kind of experience? And they're all just like, look, I finished school at 3, I've got to be home by 5, otherwise my mum or dad or whoever's not going to know where I am. If you can't see me within that time, then I'm going to go. And I think, again, it's a bit like that young person's probably really had to like get the balls up to come in the first place. We really have to kind of make things easy for them to come in, you know. And we do have increased rates now of sort of issues in the young population, you know. There's a lot of, you know, there's a real lack of sort of discussion around, you know, good sexual health, consent, what are kind of sexual norms, which, you know, is very much linked to kind of the lack of sex and relationships education in schools that is non-LGBT inclusive as well. Right. That's probably a whole other podcast, I imagine.
Yeah.
But, you know, and particularly where I work in South London, you know, we've got high rates of grooming, sexual coercion. And, you know, I just think for people listening that maybe think, you know, sexual health doesn't really affect me. Well, if you know any young people, if you're going to have kids yourself, you know what I mean? Actually, young people can find themselves in quite difficult situations, and sometimes being able to access a non-biased service for help can be a real lifeline. So I think it's just about remembering that even though you might think that you never need sexual health, actually at various points in your life or members of your family's life or friends' lives, services, you know, can literally be just so, so important. And I think that's why as a population we do have to kind of really get behind services and kind of appreciate them, you know? So yeah, absolutely. So yeah, you're absolutely right. It's always going to affect some groups more than others.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I think there's been quite a lot in the news about increases in STIs, particularly syphilis.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe in London, or just in general. Why is that? Is that just because more people are going in and getting tested? Or is there actually something going on?
It's probably a few different things. Okay, so yeah, it can be really easy to sort of say STI rates are all going through the roof. When you actually dissect it, it's not all doom and gloom. So HIV rates, as we've already talked about, are decreasing, which is fabulous. Rates of genital warts are going down. So that's thanks to the HPV vaccination schedule that girls are now receiving at school. So that's really good news. Rates of chlamydia sort of seem quite steady-ish, but do, again, disproportionately affect young people. And that's why we need to keep getting young people in for tests. Syphilis rates, you're absolutely right, is the big thing. So syphilis rates are at their highest now than they've ever been since like the late 1940s or something bonkers like that. But the group that it's affecting is men who have sex with men. Now, the thing is, some of the percentages you might see are really big. It's like increased by like, you know, 150% or whatever. The figures were so small at the beginning, you don't need to increase it by tons for it to sound like a huge increase. Right. But it is really significant. It is really significant. A lot of it will be to do with more testing. You know, we know particularly men who have sex with men are using sexual health services more than they used to in the past. A lot of it will be to do with sexual behaviours as well. Okay, so particularly in the HIV community, if you're on treatment, you know, that's the best thing you can do to prevent passing on HIV. So people are now maybe not using condoms so much. So that might be a reason why syphilis rates are going up a bit.
Right.
And the other big thing to remember is you can pass on syphilis through oral sex as well. And, you know, in the sexual health community, we know that people don't really use condoms for oral sex. It just doesn't have to be anal or vaginal sex to pass on syphilis. So that is something to remember as well.
Okay. And you mentioned earlier the mental health impact that this can be having on people accessing, you know, reproductive health services. Are you able to expand on that a little bit more? You know, thinking about, I'm thinking about people who won't be able to, who are struggling to get access to, you know, if they are like a survivor of some sort of abuse, or if they want to go, they would just want to have a conversation, find out their options. You know, what is this is obviously going to have a knock-on effect, surely. And is mental health a part of that, do you think?
Well, yeah, definitely. I mean, we know that sexual health and mental health are linked, okay? And I think particularly for certain groups, so our LGBT community, you know, within that, particularly in our trans community, there's extremely high levels of poor mental health. And I think the first thing to sort of point out is that if you can help people make, you know, good decisions about their sexual health, if you can empower them, if you can enable them to make healthy choices, that's a tool you can give people for life. I think the second thing to say is quite often people come in, they've maybe really struggled with their sexuality or their, you know, their gender, and quite often it can be a bit of an in coming and talking to a professional. We can say, well, look, you know, I can give you direction towards peer support groups, one-to-one support groups. You know, I can give you some direction. You're not alone. I think that's a really big thing as well. I think something to point out is that because of the budget cuts that we've discussed already, unfortunately, a lot of support groups have lost their funding as well, in particular HIV support groups. Support groups for, you know, other communities like the LGBT community, they've lost money, and so they're not able to provide the services that they could before, which is just such a travesty, because I think sexual health is a really incredible specialty in that, you know, the strides we've made in the past 30 years just surpass, you know, I think anything that anybody could have expected. And I think in, you know, 2019, we are in a position now where, you know, people are more open-minded, and, you know, I think we are making really, really good progress. And it's just the worst time possible, because, you know, I think it can take years and years and years to make a teeny little bit of progress, but it takes no time at all for that just to fall away again. So for me, it just feels like a really, really pertinent time that, you know, this support needs to keep going.
So what does the future look like?
It's really difficult because, you know, so many changes have already taken place. So the British Association for Sexual Health and HIV, that's one of our sort of lead bodies, and they're a real voice for sexual health and HIV in the UK. And they did a survey, and what they did is they spoke to all their members. So that's mainly healthcare professionals that are working in sexual health. And they basically said to them, you know, how many of you have had to sort of turn patients away within the past week? And literally over 60% of people said they'd had to turn patients away. Many people reported, you know, cuts in clinic hours, real dissatisfaction, essentially, with the fact that they weren't able to see the patients that they would like. So I think, unfortunately, a lot of these changes are already happening. My honest answer is I don't know what the future holds. We're still doing some really positive things. There's a lot of really positive changes still happening, you know. But I think a lot of it's just going to depend on what the government decides, and in terms of funding, because that's just what we rely on so heavily now.
Right.
If anybody wants, if anyone does want to sort of support the kind of challenges that we're facing, the British Association for Sexual Health are doing a petition at the moment. If you Google it, it's called Save Our Sexual Health Services, SOS, and it's a 38 degrees petition, and we're trying to get 9,000 signatures, and we're very, very close. So you can just go on and sign that if you're interested as well.
So one thing that I just kind of thought of that I wanted to double check, so you mentioned that contraception is free if you know how to access it. What are the options, you know? Because I remember when I went to university and they put me on the pill, I didn't go on the pill for contraceptive reasons, but it ended up just being like a bonus. Anyway.
Yeah.
They put me on it for my skin. And the doctor wrote like the female sign on my prescription, you know, like the sign for it, and was like, oh, because that you'll get it for free that way. Like, are there instances where it's not for free, or is it always free? I guess I'm trying to get at the accessibility of contraception and trying to like debunk some myths about it.
So as far as I'm aware, anybody of reproductive age and capability, so to speak, anybody that is able to get pregnant and doesn't want to get pregnant can access contraceptive services for free. Okay. The access we've talked about, but once you're in there, absolutely you can get hold of whatever methods that particular service offers.
Right.
So you've got to remember that that will vary from clinic to clinic. So the hospital I work in is what we call a tertiary service. So we offer, you know, the vast majority of contraceptives. Some smaller clinics might offer a limited selection. Your GP will be able to offer, you know, a varied selection depending on who they've got working at that clinic. And there are some sort of companies now that are offering kind of online contraceptives as well. There's a company called SH24 in South London that we're working with at our own clinic in South London, who are offering online prescriptions for the pill to try and reduce women's need to come to the clinic for repeat prescriptions. I'll be honest, I'm not aware of any instances where you shouldn't be able to get hold of something. Well, you shouldn't be able to get a hold of contraception,
right.
No.
Okay.
But I think a really important thing to say is I think a lot of patients find they go in and they don't actually have ample opportunity to talk about the methods of contraception that are available to them. I think that's something that you should try and push if you can. It's important to know what options are available to you. And if you do try, you know, a method of contraception, like say you try a contraceptive implant and you just don't like it, you don't have to stick with it. You should be able to go back and say, look, I have tried this. It's not for me. Could I try something else?
Yeah.
And I think, again, that's another thing when, you know, you're making it difficult for people to get in and get contraception. Quite often they'll be like, you know, it took me so bloody long to get this one thing. I'm not going to like go through all that again, which is just awful, because then a woman has a really bad experience of her contraception. contraception, and a bad experience of her health encounter as well. We should be making it very easy for women to sort of go in, have open front discussions, to try different types of contraception, to encourage people to want to use it in the first place, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. How can we be allies, I guess, to our NHS in terms of, you know, our reproductive health, our sexual health clinics, our local services? How can we be better allies to, you know, you guys, the doctors helping us? How can we be better allies to the people accessing the services? You know, what can we do to help?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really, really good question. Really good question. Well, the petition I've mentioned, I think on a sort of individual level, I would say, you know, when you come to a sexual health service, when you come to a clinic, you know, you quite often, if you do get an appointment, particularly in a walk-in sort of service, you know, you're going to be waiting for quite a long time. That's not acceptable, but there's not always tons we can do about it. So right. Sometimes just to remember that doctors and nurses are working as hard as they can to try and get you seen. What I would personally recommend is, you know, if you do go to your sexual health service, you do have a really long wait or you're not able to access an appointment, write to your local MP. Write to your local MP. Tell them about what's been happening. You know, it's actually really, it sounds like a real faff, but it's actually really easy to write to your local MP. You can just literally Google them or you can look on Twitter and find their handle on there. You can literally just write, you know, I went to get, you know, an implant fitted today. I went to get, you know, X, Y, and Z, and I got turned away. Like, why is this happening? You know, I think until, you know, us professionals can talk till we're blue in the face, but, you know, we do need the support of the public to kind of say, yeah, this is affecting me on a day-to-day level now. So I would encourage that.
Right. That's a really good point, actually, because I never thought about that I could write to my MP, and I never considered how easy it is. And I think the fact that you've just said and kind of demonstrated how easy it is, there's no reason why you couldn't just drop a tweet, you know, in 280 characters or whatever it is. And so my final question, what are you working on? This is a platform for you to kind of, like, you know, share what you're working on, your work. I know that you write quite a lot about this. So how can people find you and your work and whatever you're working on?
Oh, well, thanks. Yeah. So, I do some writing around some of the stuff we've talked about today, just trying to increase a bit of awareness. So I have a website if you want to have a look at that. If you just type my name in, Verity Sullivan Sexual Health, it'll hop up and there's just a list of some of the articles I've written. So again, there'll be a little bit more detail about some of the stuff we've talked about today. That's where I would direct you. I'm sort of usually working on something or other, so a few things pop up now and again.
Amazing. Verity, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Really appreciative.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. As always, thank you so much to Dr. Verity for her time, knowledge, and patience with all of this. I appreciate that with all our guests, this is a lot of, you know, emotional and intellectual labour, so I'm really appreciative of it. As always, I'm really keen to know what you guys think. Is this something that's affected you? Let me know. Get in contact. You can find me on Twitter at KitKyriarchy, or you can drop me an email, kickinthekyriarchy@gmail.com. I read everything that you send me and I try to respond to it as much as possible. And it's so important. I love hearing from you, any feedback or anything like that. So yeah, definitely get in contact. If you've listened to this episode and you think that you want to get involved and you want to take some action, think about getting involved with some charity. So for example, there's the LGBT Foundation, which is a national charity delivering advice, support and information services to people within the LGBT community, or the Terence Higgins Trust, who also provide lots of information and resources for LGBT people who are affected or just want to learn more about their sexual health and sexual health services. And they're always looking for volunteers as well, so if you aren't in the position to donate, maybe you've got some time that you can volunteer. However, having said that, I do appreciate that there is a lot of privilege associated with being an activist, having the time and the money to be able to do things. Not a lot of people have that. So even just doing things like this, listening to a podcast, putting in the effort to hear from other people, that's enough, to be honest. So if that's all you can do, that's absolutely fine. if you've got the time, rate and review the podcast, subscribe to it. Until next time, thank you so much for listening, and I will see you in 2 weeks for episode 4. We're going to be talking to Dr. Annabelle about decolonizing contraception, which I think is such an interesting topic. So you definitely do not want to miss that. I'll see you next time.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.